5. The alleged non-existence of yourself. Ajahn Chah, a 20th century Thai monk who did much to spread awareness of Vipassana meditation in the West, used to warn about the difficulty of grasping the Buddhist idea of anatta, or not-self. The basic idea is that the self, yourself, myself, in some sense, doesn't exist. To understand not-self, you have to meditate, he advised. If you try to grasp the doctrine through intellectualizing alone, your head will explode. I'm happy to report that he was wrong about the exploding head. You can try to fathom not-self without meditating and without fear of detonation. I'm not saying you'll succeed in fathoming not-self. I'll try to help you get as close to success as possible. But if at the end of this chapter you feel you still don't have a crystal-clear understanding of the idea, don't worry, you're not alone. Anyway, Ajahn Chah wasn't just making a point about the difficulty of grasping this idea intellectually. He was also underscoring the importance, in Buddhism, of grasping key ideas experientially, through meditation. There's a big difference between seeing the not-self doctrine in the abstract and really seeing, or in a way, feeling, what it means firsthand. And that's particularly true if you want to not just apprehend the idea of not-self, but actually put it to use, harness it to become a happier person, and even a better person, to feel a new sense of connection with your fellow creatures and a new sense of generosity toward them. According to Buddhism, truly, deeply realizing that you are selfless in the sense of not having a self can make you selfless in the more familiar sense of the term. Listen to how dramatically Walapola Rahula, a Buddhist monk who in 1959 published an influential book called What the Buddha Taught, put the matter. According to the teaching of the Buddha, the idea of self is an imaginary, false belief which has no corresponding reality, and it produces harmful thoughts of me and mine, selfish desire, craving, attachment, hatred, ill will, conceit, pride, egoism, and other defilements, impurities, and problems. It is the source of all the troubles in the world, from personal conflicts to wars between nations. In short, to this false view can be traced all the evil in the world. Kind of makes you wish more people would realize they don't have a self. But here we run into a problem. Experiencing full-fledged not-self is typically reported only by meditators who have done a whole lot of meditating, certainly more than I've done. If saving the world depends on a big chunk of the human race having this experience, we may be in for a long wait. But we have to start somewhere. And here there is good news. The not-self experience isn't strictly binary. You don't have to think of it as a threshold that you either manage to finally cross, to transformative effect, or forever fall short of, getting no edification whatsoever. As strange as it may sound, you can, with even a fairly modest daily meditation practice, experience a little bit of not-self. Then, as time goes by, maybe a little more. And who knows, maybe someday you'll have the full-on transformative version of the experience. But even if you don't, important and lasting progress can be made, and benefits for you and for humankind can accrue along the way. And actually, I'd say that what Ajahn Chah called intellectualizing, trying to understand not-self conceptually in the abstract, can help a person get on this path of meditative progress. Particularly worthwhile, I think, is pondering the argument that the Buddha himself made about not-self. Before we start the pondering, maybe I should put a warning label on top of Ajahn Chah's warning label, because the Buddha's argument has quirks that in some ways steepen the inherent challenge of grasping the concept. He analyzes the human mind in ways that the average psychologist, and for that matter you and I, probably wouldn't analyze it. But after this chapter, we'll be back on the firmer feeling terrain of modern science, and in the meanwhile, there is real practical value in trying to look at the whole thing the way the Buddha looked at it. The Seminal Not-Self Sermon. The logical place to begin is with the primordial text, Discourse on the Not-Self, which is said to be the Buddha's earliest utterance on the subject. The occasion for the discourse is an encounter with five monks. Events follow a pattern that's common in such encounters. The Buddha takes the monks through the logic behind some aspect of his teaching, and they are instantly persuaded. In fact, in this case, they are instantly enlightened. By the end of the discourse, they've all transitioned from being mere monks to being arhats, truly enlightened beings. These monks are said to be the first five people to have attained that rank, aside from the Buddha himself. That this historic milestone was reached via the grasping of not-self tells you something about the importance of the doctrine in Buddhist thought. And the fact that this particular discourse on not-self is the one that did the trick gives it a special place in the Buddhist canon. Like lots of doctrines in lots of ancient philosophies and religions, not-self is subject to varying interpretations, and when people argue about its true meaning, they can point to various Buddhist texts for support. But this particular text is foundational. The Buddha's strategy in this discourse is to shake the monks' confidence in their traditional ideas about the self by asking them where exactly in a human being we would find anything that warrants the label self. He conducts this search systematically. He goes through what are known as the five aggregates that, according to Buddhist philosophy, constitute a human being and that human's experience. Describing these aggregates precisely would take a chapter in itself, but for present purposes, we can label them roughly as 1. The physical body, called form in this discourse, including such sense organs as eyes and ears. 2. Basic feelings. 3. Perceptions of, say, identifiable sights or sounds. 4. Mental formations, a big category that includes complex emotions, thoughts, inclinations, habits, decisions. And 5. Consciousness or awareness, notably awareness of the contents of the other four aggregates. The Buddha runs down this list and asks which, if any, of these five aggregates seem to qualify as self. In other words, which of the aggregates evince the qualities you'd expect self to possess? Which in turn raises the question, what qualities would you expect self to possess? More fundamentally, what did the word self mean to the Buddha? Unfortunately, the Buddha didn't spend a lot of time defining his terms. Still, if you pay close attention to his arguments against the self, you can get some sense of what he meant by self, a sense of what particular properties he'd expect something worthy of the name self to have. For starters, he links the idea of self to the idea of control. Listen to what he says about the aggregate of form, the physical body. If form were self, then form would not lead to affliction, and it should obtain, regarding form, may my form be thus, may my form not be thus. But, he notes, our bodies do lead to affliction, and we can't magically change that by saying, may my form be thus. So form, the stuff the human body is made of, isn't really under our control. Therefore, says the Buddha, it must be the case that form is not self. We are not our bodies. He then goes through the other four aggregates one by one. If feeling were self, then feeling would not lead to affliction, and you'd be able to change your feelings by saying, may my feeling be thus, may my feeling not be thus. But of course, we don't ordinarily have this kind of control over our feelings, hence the tendency of unpleasant feelings to linger, even though we'd rather they didn't. So feeling, the Buddha concludes, is not self. So too with perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. Are any of these things really under control? So completely under control that they never lead to suffering? And if they're not under control, then how can we think of them as part of the self? At this point, some listeners may be puzzled and feel a question welling up that goes something like this. Wait, is the Buddha saying that the self is something that's under control? I personally would be more inclined to think of myself as the thing that's in control, kind of like the CEO of my being. Of course, you may not be one of these listeners, and in fact you may not understand why any listener would ask such a question. One problem with talking about the self is that different people have different intuitions about what the word self means. But if you do feel that question welling up within you, here is an answer of sorts. This idea of the self as a kind of CEO, as the thing that runs the show, does appear more clearly in other Buddhist texts, where the existence of such a self is denied. And one could mount an argument that in this discourse, the Buddha is implicitly denying the existence of such a self. In any event, we'll get into the existence, or lack thereof, of the CEO self in the next chapter. For now, my advice is to not worry about following every nuance of the argument the Buddha is making here. The main thing is to get a feel for the texture of it. It's the texture of the argument, the way the Buddha does this item-by-item inventory of a human being as he searches for signs of self that will come in handy when we start thinking about how a meditator, even a beginning meditator, can make use of the not-self idea. Control isn't the only property that people tend to associate with the self, and it's not the only property the Buddha examines in this discourse. When I think of myself, I think of something that persists through time. I've changed a lot since I was 10 years old, but hasn't some inner essence, my identity, myself, in some sense endured? Isn't that the one constant amid the flux? The Buddha would naturally be skeptical of this claim, since he holds that everything is in flux and nothing is permanent. In the Discourse on the Not-Self, he applies this skepticism to each of the five aggregates. What do you think of this, O monks? Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Obligingly, the monks reply, "Impermanent, O Lord." He continues, "Is perception permanent or impermanent?" And so on. Mental formations, the body, consciousness. None of the aggregates is permanent, the monks agree. So two of the properties commonly associated with a self, control and persistence through time, are found to be absent, not evident in any of the five components that seem to constitute human beings. This is the core of the argument the Buddha makes in this first and most famous discourse on not-self, and it's commonly taken as the core Buddhist argument that the self doesn't exist. Does not-self really mean no self? But this landmark argument that the self doesn't exist has one odd feature, an occasional tendency to suggest that the self exists. Near the end of the discourse, delivering the take-home lesson, the Buddha instructs the monks to go through each of the aggregates and say, "This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself." He says that a monk who follows this guidance unswervingly becomes passion-free. In his freedom from passion, he is emancipated. Okay, fine, but if there's no self, then what is the nature of the he that is liberated after all the things that aren't self have been disowned? Who is doing the disowning? If you don't exist, then how can you say of each aggregate, "This is not mine, this I am not"? If it makes sense to say there's something you don't possess and that there's something you are not, then there must be a you in the first place, right? How can the Buddha, on the one hand, insist that the self doesn't exist and, on the other hand, keep using terms like I and you and he and she? One common Buddhist response to these kinds of questions is this. Though in the deepest sense the self doesn't exist, human language isn't very good at describing reality at the deepest level. So as a practical matter, as a linguistic convention, we have to talk about there being an I and a you and a he and a she. In other words, the self doesn't exist in an ultimate sense, but it exists in a conventional sense. There. Did that clear things up? No, right? Then how about this less formal formulation of the same basic idea from a Buddhist teacher? You're real, but you're not really real. Still confused? Then maybe you should try another approach to resolving the paradox. Consider the possibility that in this famous sermon, the Buddha didn't really mean to be denying the existence of the self. If you're wondering why the last half of the previous sentence is stressed, it's to underscore what a radical idea this is, at least among mainstream Buddhist thinkers. Still, it's an idea that has been taken seriously by a few maverick scholars. It's worth exploring. A heresy examined. One point these mavericks tend to make is that nowhere in that first foundational discourse on not-self does the Buddha actually say that the self doesn't exist. He does say that each of the five aggregates is not-self, but he doesn't claim that examining the five aggregates constitutes an exhaustive search for the self. Maybe there's more to a person than five aggregates. Well, maybe. But if you raise this possibility, you'll get blowback from the many non-maverick Buddhist scholars who insist that, no, according to Buddhist philosophy, the five aggregates are all there is to a person, even if the Buddha didn't say that in this particular discourse. And it's true that the exhaustiveness of the five aggregates did become a tenet of Buddhist philosophy. Then again, so did the idea that the self doesn't exist. But we're not asking whether these things are part of Buddhist philosophy. We're asking whether they were originally part of Buddhist philosophy, whether the Buddha himself held them. And the point is just that neither of them is explicit in what is said to be the Buddha's first big statement on the subject. Anyway, this is one possible way to explain what the Buddha had in mind when he talked as if there is a you that abandons the five aggregates and is liberated after the abandonment. Maybe, in the Buddha's view, there was more to you than the five aggregates in the first place. There's a second related scenario that might explain where we find the you that is liberated after the aggregates have been abandoned. Maybe not all aggregates are created equal. Maybe one of them, consciousness, is special. Maybe after you let go of all five aggregates, it's this one aggregate that is liberated, released from entanglement with the other four. And maybe that's what you are after letting go of the idea of the self, a kind of purified form of consciousness. There's an obvious problem with this scenario that non-mavericks would be quick to point out. The Buddha does, in this first discourse on the not-self, talk as if you abandon consciousness just as thoroughly as you abandon the other aggregates. As if, in other words, the you that is left after liberation is no more closely associated with consciousness than with the other aggregates. It's a valid point. On the other hand, there are discourses, not many but some, in which the Buddha seems to sing a slightly different tune. In one discourse, describing what happens after you take the not-self teaching seriously and abandon your attachment to the five aggregates, he says that consciousness itself is liberated. What's more, as he describes the state of this liberated consciousness, he shifts almost seamlessly to describing the state of the person who has been liberated. He says of consciousness, "By being liberated, it is steady. By being steady, it is content. By being content, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains nirvana." When the Buddha puts it like this, speaks of consciousness itself as being liberated, he frames the relationship between consciousness and the other four aggregates in an interesting way. In its ordinary form, the form with which all of us unenlightened beings are familiar, consciousness is engaged with the other four aggregates, the Buddha says. It is engaged with feeling, with mental formations, with perception, with the body. This doesn't just mean that consciousness has access to perceptions, bodily sensations, and so on. After all, even the consciousness of a fully enlightened being would have access to these things. Otherwise, if there weren't access even to perceptions, for example, there wouldn't be much, if anything, for enlightened beings to be conscious of. Engagement refers, rather, to a stronger connection between consciousness and the other aggregates. Engagement is the product of a lust, as the Buddha puts it, that people have for the aggregates. There is a clinging to them, a possessive relationship to them. In other words, the engagement persists so long as the person fails to realize that the aggregates are not self. The person clings to emotions, thoughts, and other elements of the aggregates as if they were personal belongings, but they're not. This discourse, the Buddha's discourse on engagement, suggests an appealingly simple model. Liberation consists of changing the relationship between your consciousness and the things you normally think of as its contents, your feelings, your thoughts, and so on. Once you realize that these things are not self, the relationship of your consciousness to them becomes more like contemplation than engagement, and your consciousness is liberated. And the you that remains, the you that, in that first discourse on the not-self, the Buddha depicts as liberated, is this liberated consciousness. I wish I could say this scenario cleanly and definitively answers the riddle I set out to answer. Namely, if the five aggregates are all there are to a person, where do you find the he who, in that first discourse on the not-self, is said to be liberated? Unfortunately, the more deeply you delve into the discourse on engagement, confront its ambiguities and seeming inconsistencies, ponder translation issues, and weigh ancient commentaries on it, the harder it is to confidently extract any such simple scenario. Besides, there's no denying that the Buddha repeatedly, in that first not-self discourse and elsewhere, does say that consciousness is not-self, something that you have to let go of for liberation to happen, which seems quite at odds with the prospect that you can happily inhabit the consciousness aggregate once it is disengaged from the other four aggregates. But don't give up on this prospect quite yet. Some philosophers of Buddhism have suggested that maybe there are two kinds of consciousness, or two modes of consciousness, or two layers of consciousness, or however you want to think of them. One is the kind of consciousness you're liberated from, and the other is the kind of consciousness that stays with you, that is you, after the liberation. The first kind of consciousness is deeply entangled with, fully engaged with, the contents of the other aggregates, and the second kind is a more objective awareness of those contents, a more contemplative consciousness that persists after the engagement has been broken. Advanced meditators sometimes report experiencing a witness consciousness that seems to roughly fit this description of the second kind of consciousness, and some of them experience it for a long time. Maybe if it lasted forever, they could claim to be enlightened. Maybe this witness consciousness is where the you that is left over after liberation resides. Maybe. Or maybe we should just acknowledge that Ajahn Chah was onto something, trying to understand the idea of not-self by intellectualizing could make your head explode. And maybe, in light of this possibility, we should stop the intellectualizing right here. Of course, your head, though intact, may still be in a somewhat confused state. But I have good news. You don't have to dispel your confusion right now. You can wait a few years, until you've meditated so much that you become fully enlightened. Then, having directly apprehended not-self, you can explain it to me. Meanwhile, here's what I recommend. Continue to entertain the proposition you've probably been entertaining your whole life, that somewhere within you there's something that deserves the name I. And don't feel like you're committing a felony-level violation of Buddhist dogma just because you think of yourself as being a self. But be open to the radical possibility that yourself, at the deepest level, is not at all what you've always thought of it as being. If you followed the Buddha's guidance and abandoned the massive chunks of psychological landscape you've always thought of as belonging to you, you would undergo a breathtaking shift in what it means to be a human. If you attained the state he's recommending, This would be very different from having a self in the sense in which you've always had one before. What exactly would it feel like? I'm not the best person to ask, since I've never abandoned massive chunks of psychological landscape. But I did have that experience I described in Chapter 2, my first success at meditating. The tension I felt in my jaw, the over-caffeinated feeling that made me want to grind my teeth, suddenly ceased to seem like part of me. And at that moment, it ceased to feel unpleasant. I was still conscious of the feeling in my jaw, but my consciousness was no longer engaged with it in the sense of having possessive feelings toward it. I hadn't let go of my attachment to all feelings, as the Buddha recommends, but I had let go of my attachment to this one feeling. I had realized, you might say, that this feeling didn't have to be part of myself. I had redefined myself in a way that excluded it. Obviously, the feeling was still in some sense part of my consciousness. But now my consciousness was contemplating it in the way that it contemplates the trees that are swaying in the breeze beyond my window as I write this sentence. I had no sense of ownership toward the tension that had made me want to grind my teeth, so I could view it with dispassion and calm. Taking the ache out of toothache. Speaking of teeth, here's something Edward Kahn's, an eminent 20th century scholar of Buddhism, wrote about the Buddhist conception of the self. If there is a tooth, and there is decay in that tooth, this is a process in the tooth and in the nerve attached to it. If now my I reaches out to the tooth, convinces itself that this is my tooth, and it sometimes does not seem to need very much convincing, and believes that what happens to the tooth is bound to affect me, a certain disturbance of thought is likely to result. In that sense, the belief in a self is considered by all Buddhists as an indispensable condition to the emergence of suffering. In other words, pain in your tooth can hurt you only if you own the tooth in the first place. I actually know a guy who has put in many, many hours of meditation and once tested this proposition. Before having a cavity filled, he decided, as a kind of experiment, to tell the dentist to skip the Novocaine. He didn't report loving the experience, but he said he preferred it to the typical post-dentist experience of walking around for hours with a partly paralyzed face. Personally, I'll take the partly paralyzed face. I don't think I could enter a state of profound mindfulness in a dentist's chair. However, once, about 10 days into a 2-week meditation retreat, I did something kind of like that. A tooth, which turned out to require a root canal, had started hurting me whenever I drank anything. The pain was sharp and could be excruciating, even if what I was drinking was at room temperature. So just to see what would happen, I sat down in my room and meditated for 30 minutes and then took a giant swig of water and made a point of bathing the tooth in it. The result was dramatic and strange. I felt a throbbing so powerful that I got absorbed in its waves. But the throbbing didn't consistently feel bad. It was right on the cusp between bitter and sweet and just teetered between the two. At times, it was even awesome in the old-fashioned sense of actually inspiring awe, breathtaking in its power, and, you might even say, its grandeur and its beauty. Maybe the simplest way to describe the difference between this and my ordinary experience with tooth pain is that there was less "youch" than usual and more "whoa" than usual. I wouldn't have been able to do this if not on retreat. 30 minutes of my workaday meditation doesn't put me in a position to view acute tooth pain so objectively as to take much of the suffering out of it. Still, this experience was testament to the fact that ownership of even serious pain is, strictly speaking, optional. Of course, tooth pain isn't as big a problem as it was in the Buddha's day, thanks to modern dentistry. What is a big problem is anxiety. And, as I noted earlier, I did manage to disown some of that the night before the talk I gave in Camden, Maine. The anxiety came to seem like something I was observing as much as feeling, something I was experiencing with dispassion. Maybe the Buddha would say that my consciousness had ceased to be engaged with the anxiety. To look at this from a slightly different angle, the key to letting go of a chunk or two of myself was to separate the act of observation from the act of evaluation. I still experienced the anxiety, but I no longer experienced it as either good or bad. As we saw in Chapter 2, feelings are designed by natural selection to represent judgments about things, evaluations of them. Natural selection wants you to experience things as either good or bad. The Buddha believed that the less you judge things, including the contents of your mind, the more clearly you'll see them, and the less deluded you'll be. Taking charge by letting go. One lesson I take away from my experience disowning these various unpleasant feelings, the tension in my jaw from overcaffeination, the tooth pain, the anxiety, is the paradox of control. All three feelings in their initial annoying persistence proved that they were not under my control. Indeed, if anything, they were controlling me. And according to the Buddha's conception of self, my lack of control over them in turn proved that they were not part of myself. But once I followed that logic, quit seeing these things I couldn't control as part of myself, I was liberated from them, and in a certain sense, back in control. Or maybe it would be better to put it this way. My lack of control over them ceased to be a problem. Note how many times the words I, me, and my appear in the previous paragraph. Proof, perhaps, of how far I am from realizing not self. At no time, either in the course of having these experiences or in the course of thinking about them later, did I come close to abandoning the concept of self altogether. But hanging on to some notion of self didn't keep me from experiencing a pretty significant redefinition of myself. A redefinition that, who knows, may be the first step toward someday experiencing full-on not-self. Maybe it's actually useful to hang on to some conception of self for a while. Maybe hanging on to it could help you get to the point where you no longer believe it exists. The scholar Peter Harvey has written, "One can then perhaps see the self idea as fulfilling a role akin to a rocket which boosts a payload into space against the force of gravity. It provides the force to drive the mind out of the gravity field of attachment to the personality factors, the aggregates. Having done so, it then falls away and is burnt up, as itself a baseless concept." In any event, Harvey believes the not-self teaching is not so much a thing to be thought about as to be done. And who knows, maybe that was the Buddha's view of the matter. Maybe he wasn't really trying to articulate a doctrine, but rather to draw you down a path. And that path involves showing you how many things there are that you think of as part of yourself, but that don't have to be thought of that way. In this view, the Buddha, in that first discourse on the not-self, wasn't delivering a lecture about metaphysics or the mind-body problem or anything else so purely philosophical. He was just trying to get the monks to think about their minds in a way that would lead them toward liberation. This might explain that feature of the discourse that people who think of the self as a CEO find odd, that the Buddha's criterion for labeling a part of you not self is that it's not under control rather than it's not in control. Maybe by not self, the Buddha just meant something like not usefully considered part of yourself or not to be identified with. In which case, he was basically saying, look, if there's part of you that isn't under your control and therefore makes you suffer, then do yourself a favor and quit identifying with it. This interpretation meshes well with the guidance he offers near the end of the discourse, when he says that the proper attitude toward each of the five aggregates is, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. In a way, we're back to square one, Ajahn Chah's opening advice about the not-self doctrine. Don't think about it so much, just do it. but I hope you think that thinking about it has been useful. Later we'll hear from someone who seems to have not just thought about it, but done it. Someone who says that, after abandoning ownership of larger and larger chunks of what we traditionally think of as the self, he finally let go of all of it. But for now, my advice to beginning meditators is this. Don't take the idea of not-self too seriously. Maybe the contemplative path will eventually lead you to the experience of full-on not-self, and you'll come to believe that, in a profound and hard-to-describe sense, there's no I in there. Until then, just be guided by the less dramatic lessons from the Buddha's not-self discourse. Think of yourself as having, in principle, the power to establish a different relationship with your feelings and thoughts and impulses and perceptions, the power to disengage from some of them, the power to, in a sense, disown them, to define the bounds of yourself in a way that excludes them. Think of some degree of liberation as being possible, and don't worry about the fact that this would seem to imply that there's a self to be liberated. There are worse things than being a self that gets liberated. By the way, at the risk of draining this whole subject of some drama, in my own view, these arguments over what the Buddha actually believed about the self are in one sense pointless. There's roughly no chance that all the sayings attributed to him in Buddhist texts were uttered by him. In fact, some scholars will tell you that there is little or nothing in these texts that we can confidently attribute to him. Like the historical Jesus, the historical Buddha is hard to discern through the mists of history. Just as the gospel accounts of Jesus are products of evolution, of oral and textual accretion over time, so are ancient accounts of the Buddha's utterances. Even assuming that most of these accounts were originally grounded in things he actually said, they were subject to amendment, intentional or not, as they passed through the generations. In this light, it's hardly surprising that there should be inconsistencies and outright contradictions within the Buddhist canon. Still, amid all the disagreement over what the Buddha said and what the Buddha meant, there are some themes that everyone agrees are part of the Buddhist tradition from early on. And one of these is that our conception of ourselves is, at best, wildly off the mark. We associate the self with control and with firm persistence through time. But on close inspection, we turn out to be much less under control and much more fluid, with a much less fixed identity than we think. In the next chapter, we'll start to see what modern psychology has to say about all of this. Does psychology tend to corroborate the Buddhist view? Does it suggest that our common sense conception of the self as a solid, enduring core that keeps the system under control is actually an illusion? Does it lend credibility to the Buddhist idea that disowning large chunks of the self, and maybe someday disowning the whole thing, could actually bring you closer to the truth? In my view, the answers are yes, yes, and yes.